This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is In Our Time. We are all aware that we live in an era of rapid globalization, a time when boundaries of culture and politics are being breached by computing technologies. At the same time, it is always a little surprising to see how well or how badly that technology control activities at a distance. Such is the subject of this podcast, which is entitled Figures in the Distance. Even though Fiona was certain that we would talk about her, Ted and I never once mentioned her name in our conversation. Fi, as she is known to her friends, is convinced that the two of us hold strong opinions about her life, her plans for the future, and the young men who clamor for her attention. Fi claims to have solid grounds for her concerns. Ted is, after all, her father, and has 25 years of experience with her life that range from stories that encompass the merely embarrassing to the tragically compromising. I, of course, was her teacher, and because of that, I have just guided her through that last step of the transition from senior adolescent to young adult. If any two men on this earth possess information that could control Fiona's life, I suppose that they are Ted and myself. Fi needn't have worried. Ted and I both know that we have no power over her. We both know that we couldn't begin to understand her life, though we might like to think that we could. We have no real information about Fi's situation, her choices, her plans. Hence, we have no ability to redirect her life. Besides, Ted and I have far more enjoyable subjects to discuss. Ted's recent visit gave the two of us a very brief opportunity to talk about the world's problems with no constraints, no calendar, and with no budget limitations. Ted runs a large laboratory that has been operating for some 50 or so years. The organization has been a leader in the development of modern technology, including some important applications for computers. But many observers feel that this laboratory is nearing the end of its useful life. Within the next few years, these experts claim, the lab will cease to contribute anything of value to the world. At that point, the managers will be faced with a large, unutilized workforce that will be tormented by the memory that they once did something important. Those managers will have no choice but to shutter the building, put a historic plaque on the gate, and turn the engineers onto the street to beg for spare change that they might pay their professional dues. I've never worked in Ted's laboratory, and hence I was not disciplined by the nature of the situation. I was free to invent any operational detail I desired and to manipulate those details at will. Lines of control, departmental resources, operational routines, production metrics. All of these things came freely from my imagination as I speculated on ways to reorganize the institution. For a little more than an hour, Ted and I indulged in fantasy management, directing not the real laboratory, or even a useful abstraction of the truth, but an institution made of words and lies and wishful thinking. We finished our time together with that burst of adrenaline and camaraderie, causing us to believe that we had conquered time and space, even though we had not an ounce of evidence to support our conclusions. Despite all of our protests to the contrary, Fi was completely convinced that her father and I had spent the hour talking about her. "Dad had a very good time," she noted. "We have a lot in common," I responded. She looked at me as if I had just confessed to her worst fears. But our conversation quickly moved to discussing her job and her effort to establish a career. She works for one of those new media firms, a company that's trying to make money by selling advertising on web pages that contain some little teeny minimal amount of information. We chatted for a few minutes about revenue streams, about click-throughs, about demographics, about strategies. And then suddenly, a troubled look flashed across her face. "My boss is moving to California," she said, "and is going to have her second baby in October." "So who will manage your office?" I asked. "My boss," she replied. At this point, I paused, understanding neither the changes to her office nor the issue of concern to her. To probe the situation, I started to ask questions that would get Phi to maybe answer yes. It's a strategy I learned from my mother, who is a primary school teacher. "You learn nothing from children," she would say, "until they say yes to 3 consecutive questions." "So, are you moving to California?" I began. "No," she said. "I'm staying right here." "Will someone new oversee the daily operations of your office?" "No," she repeated. "My boss will still run the group, over the internet, after she delivers her baby." At this point, I felt that I had learned nothing, but I continued, "with no local manager." "None," she said, before uttering the phrase that would explain the entire situation. "Except, perhaps, for me." Phi, by her nature, wanted order, discipline. With her manager on a distant coast and preoccupied with a new baby, Phi saw the responsibilities of running her office resting upon her shoulders alone. She doubted that her colleagues would get the work done on their own. She doubted that email was an adequate tool to convey the complexities of daily operations. She feared that her boss would be unable to follow the tasks of the office. Chaos and old night were descending upon her. Phi knew this as certainly as she knew that Ted and I had spent an hour together conspiring to manage her life. The technologies that we have deployed over the past 2 decades have given us new ability to manage activities at a distance. Engineers use them to manage production workers. Schedulers use them to coordinate distribution channels. Fathers use them to manage daughters, though I suspect that efforts in this last direction are less effective than most fathers would like. In looking at the problem of distant management, we see that a good communication mechanism is only one of the tools that we need to control distant activities. We also need to be able to abstract the nature of those activities, determine the best measures for describing workflow, and create ways of ensuring trustworthiness. Ultimately, all of these elements play a role in determining the success of a new managerial scheme. I'd not thought much about the changes in distant management until a friend, Yu Gong, told me that he had started a new business in China. "So," I asked, "does this mean that you've left California?" "No," he responded. "I love San Diego. I never want to leave." "Do you travel to China often?" I asked. "No," he replied. "About every 3-4 months. I don't much like the long flight, though it does give me the opportunity to read all the technical publications that have been accumulating on my desk." "So, you have someone there who handles the day-to-day management," I concluded. "No," he said. "I do it all myself, over the internet." Yu Gang went on to explain that his firm deals with a single, highly abstract class of technical problems. Using a set of software tools, his Chinese engineers search for viable solutions. Once they find a good solution, they log it into a database. From his desk in California, Yu Gang can easily track the work being done on the other side of the Pacific. He can verify the validity of the solutions, determine how those solutions were created, and even learn how much computer time each solution required. After Yu Gang explained his process, I noted that many a programmer, far less skilled than his engineers, had found ways of appearing to keep a computer busy when in fact they were merely spinning disk drives and flashing meaningless symbols on a screen. Yu Gang laughed at this. "It hasn't happened yet," he said. "So far, we've been able to produce the work we need without using excessive resources." Although companies like Yu Gang's technology business are relatively new, the phenomena of distant management has an extensive history. For centuries, a good way of making money has been to create goods in one market and then to sell them in another. When the distance between the two markets precludes daily contact, merchants employ other strategies to maintain their business. In the past, they would look for partners who could be trusted with resources and who would reliably report the business conditions in the distant market. Well into the 19th century, wrote the business historian James Benninger, merchants managed their distant operations with whatever communications they could manage, which usually meant hiring and distributing family members in key commercial centers and relying on a traditional code of family and commercial honor. Sons could often be loyal representatives in distant centers as they stood to inherit the accumulated wealth. However, they could easily have a sense of entitlement that caused them to challenge their father's leadership, or even to squander their inheritance in riotous living. Impoverished nephews were better, as they had fewer options for independent action. Ambitious sons-in-law were often the preferred representative, as their loyalty was ensured by the dutiful daughter who remained at home with her father. Modern communications technologies has reduced the need for capitalists to have large families with dutiful daughters to marry loyal sons-in-law, but they did not entirely solve the problem of distant management, for they uncovered the hidden problems of trust. It is far easier to lie to someone distant than to somebody nearby, especially when a political or cultural boundary lies between the sender and the recipient. The telegraph, the telephone, the internet have only served to spread the three great lies of business, the misrepresentations that begin by claiming that the prospects here are good, and then move on to claim we will easily meet our goals for the quarter, before ending with that classic falsehood, the check is in the mail. Moving in parallel to the growth of communication was the expansion of abstraction, of using numbers and formulas to describe the activities of business and business relationships. Cost accounting, production reports, financial statements, sales figures. The language of quantification is a technology of distance, wrote the philosopher Ted Porter. It exacts a severe discipline from its users, a discipline that is nearly uniform over most of the globe. Of course, numbers by themselves do not necessarily represent truth, as the old British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli noted when he classed statistics with the more obvious forms of misrepresentation, those of lies and damnable lies. However, quantification came with abstract models of business, rules for gathering data, and acceptable forms for presenting conclusions. It may be admitted that office work is difficult to measure, wrote management consultant William Henry Leffingwell. Yet without it, the manager cannot know whether he is managing the office efficiently or is keeping on force more clerks than are actually required. Leffingwell was one of the management consultants of the early 20th century, a group of individuals who worked to discipline manufacturing procedures and reduce the expense of operations. Often called efficiency experts, these consultants are not normally included in the pantheon of those contributing to the modern computer and to the modern age of globalization, as they did nothing with electronic machinery and had only a passing connection to programs and algorithms. Yet, by providing the ways to standardize business information, they opened the way to control commerce with the stored program. Control, wrote Leffingwell, involves a very extensive knowledge of numerous details which cannot be remembered by any ordinary individual. He argued that such details needed to be abstracted into a routine or an algorithm so that the manager could verify that the work was being done without the necessity of personally knowing all the details that are involved. The abstract routines of the efficiency experts allowed business activities to move across political and cultural boundaries. Knowing only a few basic facts about the routine, managers could make decisions about the allocation of resources and the scheduling of operations. They did not need to know the location of an office or the nature of the workers or cost, speed, amount of product. That was all that the manager needed to know. And that information could be easily transmitted over a wire. Among the 20th century notables in this field of efficiency management are a few familiar people. Henry Gantt, who invented the product schedule that bears his name. Frederick Winslow Taylor, who is considered the founder of the faith. Perhaps the best known of these management experts are Frank and Lillian Gilbreth. Their daughter, Ernestine, and her brother, Frank, recorded the Gilbreth story in a book called Cheaper by the Dozen. The younger Gilbreths tell of a family that was sort of a school for scientific management. It had set standard ways of washing dishes, a sealed bid system for awarding household jobs, and even a process chart that organized the events of the day and allocated precious resources, such as time in the bathroom. It was regimentation, all right, remembered the two siblings. But bear in mind the trouble that most parents have in getting just one child off to school, and multiply that by 12. Most parents have at least a little in common with the Gilbreths, though few have 12 children, as they did. These parents often attempt to abstract their child's life into a weekly schedule, a list of tasks, a chart of goals for the summer. Some have speculated that such techniques, when combined with a good internet connection or maybe just a cell phone, might allow them to manage the distant life of a grown-up son or daughter. Perhaps such control is possible, although in my experience, it has never worked any better than the managerial plans we create when we gossip about failing sports teams, dissolute celebrities, or aging laboratories that are in the need of reorganization. Well, once again, you've been listening to In Our Time. This podcast was based on an essay published in the August 2008 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about Computer and the Computer Society can be found at www.computer.org. To find the information about Computer, just click on the Publications tab and go to Technical Magazines. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. If you have any comments, we'd love to hear them. You can send them to our email, which is podcasts@computer.org. The music that you've just been hearing on this podcast comes from a website known as the Podshow Podsafe Music Network. We're very grateful for them, and you can find it at music.podshow.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.